You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Thousands of Wisconsinites each year get trapped in what our next guest calls financial quicksand by taking out short-term, extremely high interest rate loans. State lawmakers from both parties are working on new legislation on payday loans and other financial products aimed at reforming the lending practices that are often referred to as predatory. Bill sponsors cite a 2021 report from the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions showing Wisconsin payday loans is having an effective annual interest rate of 536%. We're going to check out these lending practices, why many experts say they can be dangerous loans, plus resources that can help people deal with this kind of debt and the potential impact of proposed legal changes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you ever taken out one of these payday loans or other short-term, potentially high-interest loans? Were you able to pay it off in time, or did you get caught in a kind of cycle? And whether or not you've interacted with these kind of loans, do you have thoughts on what they are, questions about how they work, changes you'd like to see in the law? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Sarah Orr is clinical professor and director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the UW Law School. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
Can you start off with the basics? What do we mean when we talk about payday loans in particular?
Payday loans are short-term consumer loans, and they typically come with very high interest rates, as you mentioned from the DFI report. And they are typically made for, 90 days, fewer than 90 days, where people have to pay the loan off within that time period.
And there are payday lenders. There are other kinds of sort of short-term, potentially high-interest loans. Is there a lot of variety in these potentially risky products?
Well, I think there is. And you mentioned what the proposal that is now being working its way through the legislature about changing the definition of payday loans, which I think has a lot of good attributes to it. The main one being that it extends it defines payday loan as a loan with a term of 90 days to 6 months. So it wouldn't mature, in 90 days, let's say. And I applaud that change because I think it really does reflect the products that we at the Consumer Law Clinic have seen people trying to manage. So we haven't seen a lot of these fewer than 90-day loans, as payday loan is currently defined, but we have seen more that are for longer periods of time and are structured more like installment loans, where a part of the payment that a person must make, when every payment is due, goes toward principal and some toward the interest.
One argument from the industry in the ongoing debate over regulation has been, these loans are going to people who don't really have another recourse. Maybe they don't have another option when they need short-term money. And B, those annual rates, well, if you pay it off in those 90 days, those annual rates aren't going to come up. So not a big deal. Your thoughts on how the industry has presented itself?
Well, I think I'm familiar with the message that it helps people who are in a bind, a temporary bind, to pay something that has come due, and you can get the money quickly and take care of whatever obligation has arisen. But studies have found that, in fact, people, once they take one or two of these out, the financial emergency really becomes paying on these products. And so they may pay just to roll it over to the next period and really are not making any progress toward paying down the loan itself. And so I think that studies out there, there's an excellent one. It's an old study now, but it's called Phantom Need, where it kind of debunks that idea that these are intended for people for short-term financial needs. And the other part is that at such high interest rates, these products are unaffordable really from the get-go, even with the best of intentions of paying it back. Or making the payments when the payments come due, the fact of the high interest really makes them unaffordable. And I have seen in the clinic over my time there that they are affecting not only people who are living in poverty, but people who are of modest means and modest incomes.
Talking to Sarah Orr, clinical professor, director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School, looking at payday loans and other high interest short-term loans. A few different pieces of legislation in the works here in Wisconsin that would change how those industries are regulated. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions or maybe an experience to share. That's 800-642-1234. You mentioned, Sarah, one of those pieces of legislation that would expand the legal definition of a payday loan. There's another one led by Republican state senators here, including Andre Jacques, that would propose putting a cap on the annual percentage interest rates for these loans at 36%, which still sounds high, a lot lower than that 500 some. I understand this has happened elsewhere in the U.S. in some jurisdictions. What kind of difference would that make?
I think that would make a big difference. It might bring these products into the range of affordability for people who take them out. I say, why not do both? Because, you know, as I said, as soon as you take out one of these products, if the interest rate is high, almost immediately you're going to have trouble repaying. And I wanted to point out one thing, which is kind of a little technical point, but although the pending legislation seeks to expand the definition to include loans for 90 days up to 6 months, in the loan contracts that I have seen that people are struggling to repay, the payments are still due every 2 weeks. That's kind of where the term payday loan comes from. So although it might be more like an installment loan where you're making a payment and it goes some toward principal and some toward interest, you still have to come up with a payment every 2 weeks. And that's where people really get trapped.
And then another piece of legislation, and I got to admit, this one kind of baffles me as I try to read through it, Sarah, has to do with reforms to wage garnishment for when people have these loans. They, I guess, default on it, and then companies are looking to collect this debt. This is Senate Bill 327. Can you help me make sense of that?
I can. Actually, I've spent time with this bill. I went into it deeply and have determined that really the bill is about making sure that individuals who have a court order for repayment under the victim restitution statute are able to get that court order sort of in a position to be paid back through a garnishment of the debtor's earnings. And so at first I was alarmed because it talked about, you know, a 13-week time period that we're used to seeing in garnishment. But I did determine that I think it will not have a negative effect on consumers as we know it. But I still do want to make the point that wage garnishment can be very confusing for folks. We see people who are dealing with old money judgments from courts. They may have participated in the court process or they may not have. And they may not even remember having a judgment or may not be aware until their wages are garnished. And this is an area that my clinic really is focusing a lot on because it affects so many Wisconsinites. I guess my message is that the wage garnishment process has a lot of protections for debtors, but also balances the rights of the judgment creditor to be paid without really impoverishing the people who owe the money.
We're talking about problems and concerns associated with payday loans and proposals in the legislature intended to help tackle at least some of those problems. Sarah Orr is with us, clinical professor and director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the UW Law School. Coming up, we'll look at some resources available, especially for people who might be in a cycle of short-term loan debt. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about how this all works. Do you think that the annual interest rates, as one piece of legislation would do, should be capped for these short-term loans? And have you had an experience with them for better or worse? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sarah Orr, clinical professor and director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the University of Wisconsin Law School. We're looking at bipartisan proposals in the state legislature aiming to fix some of the allegedly predatory practices associated with payday loans and other short-term high-interest lending. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts on payday lending? Do you want to see caps on interest rates as one of these law changes would tackle? Have you experienced this, or has someone in your family gotten caught up in this short-term debt where they're having to take out new short-term loans to pay off the old short-term loans? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah, I want to talk about resources available. Someone, say, who is caught in that cycle. They took one of these loans, couldn't pay it off. They're maybe taking on more and more debt at high, high interest. What are some resources through your clinic or elsewhere that they could reach out to?
Well, unfortunately, we're not able to do financial advising in that respect. There are some nonprofit organizations that can work with someone to look at what kinds of credit products they are dealing with and how to allocate payments or not. I mean, our message really, when we start to meet with a person who's now in the legal end of dealing with this kind of debt, is that they need to make the decisions that are best for themselves and their families. And we're not encouraging people to not pay on their debts. And frankly, I don't think I've met a person in my years at the law school who does not want to pay the debt back. Mm-hmm. They really struggle with it. There's a lot of shame attached to this and a lot of pressure. And so, you know, if you can get yourself to a financial advisor, there are some free services available out there to just help you take some steps toward getting a handle on it. We strongly advise that. Unfortunately, many times, you know, if a person is dealing with credit card debt or private student loan debt or debt that's coming from, you know, after a vehicle has been repossessed and they still owe on the loan, that's when people can come to our clinic for assistance and we can help them navigate the process, understand the legal process and represent them if necessary.
Yeah, we were talking about if you get your wages garnished because of this kind of debt we're talking about, if someone's in a position where all of a sudden, maybe unexpectedly, wages are coming off of their paycheck to pay off those debts, is there potentially legal recourse? Can you make a case that this is, punitive, making it hard to live?
Well, people have a lot of... they have a right to basic income and basic financial protections against wage garnishment. And I say to your audience members that you can take action on a garnishment at any time during the garnishment. And at the beginning of the garnishment, you should have received some papers, but for many people that's long ago. And so if you come to the realization that you are under a garnishment of your wages, please do reach out to my clinic and my students and I can assist you in understanding the process and getting you the forms that you need to do to fill out to communicate with your employer. So the employer is brought into the debt collection process in these cases and the communication goes from the consumer to the employer. But we're, you know, my students are trained and supervised. We're all set to handle and help people navigate the process and assert the rights that they have under our statutes.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Matthew is with us in Dane County. Matthew, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
I was wondering if the legislation is going to involve auto title loans at all, because that's something I've dealt with in the past. And unfortunately, it's affected, this was years ago, but it affected my ability to register a vehicle, and I had a vehicle repossessed. So I was just, wondering if this was going to be something where they addressed, you know, some of the issues, I guess the parallel issues that exist within the auto title industry as well, or if they commingle at all.
Matthew, thanks a lot for sharing that experience. Sarah, is that are these auto title loans in this category of short-term, potentially high-interest loans we're talking about?
Matthew, I'm sorry you had to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Auto title loans are one of the worst financial products out there in terms of, you know, trapping consumers. And unfortunately, the legislation does not deal with auto title loans. And so it would not, you know, improve that industry or improve those products.
Thanks for the call, Matthew. As part of the story here, Sarah, a lot of the so-called payday lending is collateral-free loans. The bank or the lender won't take away a thing from you. They'll just keep racking up interest and penalties, whereas an auto title loan is against your auto title. There's a collateral there. So does the law look at this as a different kind of lending?
That's exactly correct. Yes.
Matthew, thanks again for sharing that experience. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hi. I was just wondering, why isn't there some type of rule or legislation or something at the end of all these commercials where they're really friendly about giving you a loan? They're like, oh, we'll help you out. There should be a disclaimer somewhere at the end where it says, by the way, if you do this with us, you must pay us back or we'll garnish your wages. So that way, I mean, I know better than to do any of that. But, like, there's just some people that are so in desperate need that they're going to do it anyways. But they should be made aware that there's recourse for them not paying it back like they're supposed to. And it should be at the end of these very friendly commercials.
Liz, thanks for the call, Sarah. I'm guessing there's some very fine print somewhere along the way. But do you agree with Liz that there needs to be more transparency about the terms of these loans?
Absolutely, I agree. Another aspect of this that is, you know, happening as we speak are a lot of new apps that are coming out that allow people to obtain small loans, quick loans, also, you know, borrowing against their wages and so forth. And so that's another area that is of high concern for us, because people, you know, feel the pressure of time. And if you're putting something right in front of them that meets that pressure, you know, they're going to get trapped in this. And the disclosures really, either they're extremely tiny or they're at the end of a process or nobody reads them. You know, I can't agree more with the caller.
Liz, thanks for the call. Tim is with us now in North Prairie. Hi, Tim.
Yeah, predatory lending is not appropriate. I mean, I think we'd all agree on that. That has mainly to do with interest rates. But I can't quite tell from your guest if whether or not she thinks that people should be responsible for paying back loans that they take out. You know, if they're not, then that hurts the rest of us consumers who do pay our fair share. There's a balance there. And so I'm wondering if the organization that she represents also works towards stopping predatory lending on the part of the lender, or you know, rather than just saying, well, garnishment of wages, you know, if they're making a loan payment, that's coming out of their wages too, if they were to be making them.
Tim, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. And Sarah, I think you mentioned earlier, nobody in your clinic is going to say, don't pay your debt.
That's correct. And we work with people every day who are trying to do that. And so our message is not that people don't owe the money. Our message is that people do owe the money, and there are protections for debtors who do owe the money, which include protection from unfair debt collection practices, protection in the garnishment process. And let's not forget that, you know, if it ends up in a garnishment where the person has gone into court and there's a money judgment and it's being collected through their earnings, many people aren't exempt from that. And so that's how the debt will be repaid.
Thanks again for that call. Sarah, one underlying concern I've seen in all of this is that for many, especially low-income people, they may not have a lot of banking options. They may be underbanked. Banks may not want to deal with customers who don't, have a lot of money to work with in the first place. Do you see part of the solution maybe in trying to create other options than payday lending or nothing for people?
Well, I wish there were more options out there, and I wish more people would be banked in the traditional sense. And that's where my concern comes with banking through apps and the, you know, the speedy nature of technology and the confusing language of technology that people may be getting into even deeper and faster traps. So yes, and I, this is not my area of expertise in terms of market share and so forth, but I really wish that there were more in the traditional vein lenders who are offering services and accounts for people who are underbanked.
And in just our last few moments, Sarah, if someone is in this debt cycle and thinking, okay, maybe I do need some kind of legal help out there, how do they reach out?
Well, a person could call the Consumer Law Clinic. I need to say that we don't handle bankruptcy and we can't advise about bankruptcy, but a person is welcome to call us at 608-263-6283. My students come back in about a week and we'll be able to speak with people after that. And we are also on the law school website, and that address is law.wisc.edu/EJI/CLC.
And we'll get a link up at the Central Time page at WPR.org. Sarah, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Sarah Orr, clinical professor and director of the Consumer Law Clinic at the UW Law School, talking about payday loans and maybe some changes to state law in the works. Coming up Monday on Central Time, in many communities in the U.S., walking is not always safe, with increases in pedestrian injuries and deaths, especially at night. We'll find out what could be causing the problem and check out some good news in Wisconsin. That's Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we talk to a former technology executive about what could happen to the publishing industry if streaming audiobooks start to take over the market. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Audiobooks are a big business. Over the years, they've gone from books on tape to CDs to downloads. Now they can make another big move, from paying per title to streaming. Last year, Spotify announced a new program to offer 15 free hours of audiobooks to premium customers at no extra cost. If that model expands, our next guest says the publishing industry will go through a radical transformation, similar to the one the music industry has done over the last few decades, with vanishing profit for artists and potentially a shrinking market for new material. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you listen to audiobooks? How and where do you get them? And do you use Spotify? How has Spotify changed the way you listen to music? Could it change the way you read, or in this case, listen to, books? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Kim Scott is the author of the book Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity and Radical Respect, and a former technology executive in the past working at Google, Apple, and elsewhere. Kim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm excited for our conversation.
All right, I gave a very basic taste of how the Spotify book model would work. Spell it out for us a little more, please.
So basically what will happen is, if you're a Spotify premium user, as far as I understand, you will be able to, instead of listening to music or listening to a podcast, you'll be able to choose 15 hours worth of audiobooks. And so if you start reading a book that is only 10 hours and you read, you know, only a couple hours of it and you get bored, then you can start another book. So it sounds pretty good for users. The problem is what it does for writers. On average, when a person starts an audiobook, they listen to about half of it. And so right off the bat, Spotify is only going to pay authors 50% of what they would otherwise get. If you go to Audible and buy an audiobook, Even if you only listen to half of it, the writer still gets paid their royalty. And it's not like writers are getting rich. I want to say that, too. It's not like, you know, even for a pretty successful book, I think writers already make only about $1 a book or something.
Now, you, in a piece in the New York Times, compare this to how Spotify and some other streaming platforms have changed music.
Yes.
Could you talk through what you see happening there that could make this audiobook change scary, especially for the creators?
So basically what has happened in the music industry is that the music labels were, they sort of handed over their whole, you know, all of the songs that they had ever produced to Spotify. And now musicians get paid very, very little. There are a few musicians who get paid well, but it's very much a rich get richer algorithm on Spotify. So a small number of musicians are getting all of the money. And if you want to break into the music business and you're a successful but not a wildly successful musician, you get paid basically nothing. And that is, it means that it's impossible to make a living for most musicians, just as it will become even harder than it already is to make a living as a writer.
You point toward a paradox in that piece I mentioned. The idea is, hey, streaming makes it easy for you, band people, musicians, to create music and things like that. But it may be harder because people can't make a living doing it. We are actually seeing a decline in some cases in fresh new content.
Yes. The new music that is being launched, the size of that business has actually shrunk because people can't afford to be musicians. And this is something, you know, I have some personal experience with. Earlier, before I became a writer, I managed the AdSense network at Google. And we used to say at Google, and we believed this, I mean, our intentions were truly good. We would say we're funding creativity a nickel at a time. You know, now you can just, if you want to write something, you can publish it, you can put ads against it, and you can start making money right away. But the problem, of course, is that the only people who made enough money to put food on the table were the upper 0.1% of people who were in the network. And the rest of people were making, you know, even people producing great content were making like $5 a month. And that's just not enough to live on.
We're talking to Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, former technology executive. She wrote a piece about Spotify getting into the audiobooks market. Instead of paying for a title, say, you would, as part of your membership, get to stream a certain amount. She says that could really shake up the audiobook business in a way that's bad for people who want to write and create books. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you an audiobook listener? How do you do it? Are you an author? Are you worried about this change? If you're a musician, how has streaming changed your musician life? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Kim, we've talked about the music streaming as maybe a sign of things to come for audiobooks. Now, in the publishing world, first of all, people might say, oh, audiobooks, no big deal. The main thing is we read books, right? Well, as I understand it, audiobooks these days, big business, big part of the publishing industry's business model.
Yes, and crucially, it's the growing part. In fact, the number of physical books that have been sold has actually declined in the last 5 years. But the audiobooks portion of the market is what's really growing. Because, like, I don't know about you, but I'm busy. I read probably, as my children say, you don't read them, you listen to them, Kim and Mom. You know, but I listen to, you know, probably 3 books a week. But the only reason I have time to do that is because I listen while I'm taking a walk, while I'm doing the dishes, while I'm weeding, you know, while I'm doing other things. And I think that's why that part of the market is growing, is that it's really convenient to listen to a book while you're commuting to work or something.
Now, talk us through how publishers are reacting to this thing from Spotify. Are they panicking and boycotting, or are they jumping in and saying, yes, please, line up our catalogs, let's see what happens?
Well, different publishers are reacting differently. I'm proud to say that my publisher, which is St. Martin's Press, gave me a choice as the writer. Did I want to participate or did I not want to participate? But there are some other publishers who just sort of handed over their whole portfolio of audiobooks and without asking permission of the authors. And I think that's pretty rough on the writers. And I think, you know, the promise, I want to be, I always like to listen to both sides. And Spotify, to their credit, they called me up, they explained it to me, and they believe, and I think they genuinely believe this, they believe that this is going to expand the number of readers for books. And so even though you'll only get, you know, on average, half the royalty per reader, you'll get so many more readers, you'll make up for it in volume. I haven't seen any data that proves that is true. And my assumption is that it's incorrect, but I could be wrong here. I mean, I'm not omniscient, but what I know about the way that platforms work, technology, and I know something about this from my previous career, mm-hmm. what I know about the way that tech platforms work says to me that what'll happen is the tech platform will get a bunch of users because they'll be offering this great deal on the content. And then they'll start taking more and more and more out of the content creator's piece of the action because they can, because the content creators kind of have to be on the platform. And then the content creators can no longer afford to create content. So they go get, quote unquote, real jobs.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Linda is with us in Pleasant Prairie. Linda, hi.
Hi. I have been listening to audiobooks for, probably at least 30 years. When I was working, I had a 2-hour commute every day. And
wow.
That really saved me. Yeah, but it saved me. I'd look forward to getting in the car and listening to an audiobook. I still listen to audiobooks. I love it when I'm working or making pottery. I get mine through the library. I always have. I started with the cassette tapes and then the CDs. And now I download it directly onto my phone and listen that way. I am, you know, Spotify thinks that 15 hours of an audiobook is a good deal.
Yeah, that's nothing, right?
It's nothing. Most of the books that I listen to are close to that length anyhow. So I'd be very concerned about this, and I think that artists should get paid well for what they do. It'd be very, very sad if we just kind of make this into almost a sort of plastic experience where everything's kind of the same.
Linda, thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Kim.
No, I totally agree with you, and I wanna. Sort of plus one what you said about libraries offer a wonderful service, and so many of my readers got my book from the library, so I love the library point. And I just read Middlemarch or listened to Middlemarch, and that's 32 hours. You know, it would have been terrible to stop in the middle of the book.
Thanks again for that call, Linda. We're talking to Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, former executive at Apple and Google. She's talking with us about a piece she wrote for the New York Times. Remember what Spotify did to the music industry? Books are next. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on Spotify at least dipping its toes in this idea of streaming audiobooks, X amount of audiobook time for you with your membership? Are you an audiobook listener, reader? How do you do it? Do you want to see this streaming option, or do you want to just get the titles you want? If you're a writer or a music creator, because there's a similar story there, love to hear from you about your experiences. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how Spotify may change the publishing industry by making audiobooks available as a streaming service. Our guest is Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor, former technology executive, in the past working at Apple, Google, and elsewhere. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you purchase audiobooks? Do you get them from the library? If they were part of a streaming service, Spotify or elsewhere, would you want to listen to them that way? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls. We've got J.A. with us in Phillips. J.A., hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Rob.
What did you want to tell us about? You're an author, I understand.
I am an author. Been a professional full-time author since about 2001. And as far as big shot publishers go, mainstream publishers, the contracts are pretty much what you'd expect from any big business to artists. The contracts are unconscionable, and the authors make next to nothing for books that are sold. For example, when my books were in bookstores all over the nation and the world, or when they were in Walmart, on a $7.99, $8.99 paperback, an author makes about 40 to 50 cents. And that's if they're selling lots and lots of copies. It's less than that if they sell fewer than that. On a hardcover, $25 hardcover, you're going to make about $3. So I worked very hard in the publishing industry, and I sold hundreds of thousands of hardcovers and paperbacks in the fiction, mystery, thriller, and horror fields. And then, lo and behold, this company named Amazon came along, and Amazon invented this e-reader called a Kindle. And what's wonderful about the Kindle, other than the fact that it could deliver books to you instantly, anywhere where there's any sort of internet service. What else is wonderful about it for authors is it finally paid you as an author. So rather than getting 6% for a paperback off of the cover price, you're making 70% of the price you set. So on a $5 Kindle book, I'm making over $3.
Now, Jay, I want to ask, since we've got this audiobook thing going, have you done audiobooks either with a publisher or, since it sounds like you're self-publishing now?
Well, I've done both.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, the largest independent audiobook publisher was a publisher called Brilliance Audio, located out of Grand Haven, Michigan. And they were great to work with. They were a lot of fun. I got to appear as a voice of some of my characters on many of my early audiobooks. And again, the pay was okay. I mean, you can't complain if you win the lottery and you finally get that dream agent and you get that publishing deal. And I made decent money publishing, but I didn't make as much as my publishers did. Both the print publishers and the audiobook publishers. So Brilliance would sell an audiobook for up to $40-$50 for library copies, and I'd make a couple of bucks or less than that.
Interesting. Jay, I'm going to jump in because we don't have a ton of time left, and I want to bring Kim here. Now, some authors have done really well in self-publishing, you know, e-books. There's a little more production, a whole other kind of production involved in audiobooks. Is this, do you see this as a possibility for authors to get around not just the publishers, but, say, a Spotify streaming platform if they're making their own audiobooks?
I think it's pretty hard. I mean, my experience, and I'd love to hear from the caller. I wrote 3 unpublished novels and self-published them. And I just wasn't able to get traction with those books in the way I did publishing through my publisher. So I did much better with a traditional publisher than I did on my own. But so hats off to this caller for figuring out how to sell his self-published books. You know, there's a lot of different ways to read your books, to self-publish your books. There are very few authors I know of who have been able to succeed in that way. But I remain optimistic. I think that the idea of funding creativity a nickel at a time still appeals to me. I mean, it would be nice to live in a world in which anybody could write anything, put it out there in the world, and it would have a fair shot at getting discovered. But I don't think that's the world we live in yet.
Thanks a lot for that call again, J.A. Now, Kim, let's use the word discovered. And I want to talk about discovery because you write about this in your piece. You know, when you're on a streaming platform, any kind of streaming platform, an algorithm is going to make suggestions to you.
Yes.
Do we have a sense so far of what Spotify is recommending to us when we try to stream audiobooks?
Well, it would appear that they are recommending books that either are out of copyright, and so they don't have to pay anything for those books. So on the day that it launched, a lot of people were having Karl Marx recommended to them, which, you know, didn't seem like the thing that most of us
want to read.
Seems
like there might be some socialist programmer who, like, pranked that in there. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think there's a lot of socialists working at Spotify, but I could be wrong. I think there was a Britney Spears book. So, and this is what happens. I said before that these kinds of tech platforms tend to have a rich get richer algorithm. And the reason for that is not necessarily insidious, but because the way that the algorithms work is that they figure out, you know, sort of what you're looking for. And then they also know what most other people like. And so they tend to recommend to you what most other people are reading. So, or listening to. And so as something gets more popular, it gets recommended more often, and then it gets more popular. That's what I mean by a rich get richer algorithm. And the problem with that is that if Spotify is sending most listeners to just a few different pieces of content, a few different books or a few different podcasts, then the so-called long tail, all these other smaller podcasts and books and musicians, they don't get discovered. Only the big ones do. But then there's another confounding factor, which is, you know, Spotify has maybe cut a deal with those really big musicians or authors or podcasters. And so it doesn't cost them incrementally more money to send you to them. And so they send more of you, more of that kind of content that they don't have to pay for your way. Or they can encourage people who on the other end of the mm-hmm. spectrum, you know, who are teeny tiny, who've not yet been discovered and who are willing to give their content away for free in order to get discovered. And so then they wind up sending you this kind of content that you don't really want. And in the case of books, because of copyright, they may send you Das Kapital when that's not what you're interested in reading today.
And just our last few moments, another problem. Now, we've already seen on Spotify, people are creating like noise tracks, gibberish tracks. YouTube, people
yes.
are, you know, I have a yeah. 6-second Simpsons clip. That's what my channel is. People putting up stuff either free or AI created or copyright infringing, yeah. that might be the wave of the future with these audiobooks?
Yes. I mean, once you add ads into the equation, then I think you all talked earlier this month about the impoopification mm-hmm. of content by this article by Cory Doctorow.
Right.
Once you create ads and put anybody can put up gibberish and then put ads next to it and make money, that really messes up the program. And then there's another thing to consider, which is the market. The stock market is rewarding. So I don't blame the CEO of Spotify for doing what he's doing. I would probably do the same thing if I were the CEO of Spotify, because I'd get punished by the market if I didn't do it. And so I think the only way, I went to business school, blah, blah, blah. But I think the only solution is some regulation, unfortunately, because if the logic of the algorithm and the logic of the market is pushing things in a way that is bad for content creators and ultimately bad for society, that's why we have that's why we have regulation. That's why we have a government to take care of.
Thanks to our guest, Kim Scott, author of the book Radical Candor. We've been talking about Spotify streaming audiobooks in the future. This is Central Time.